Welcome to episode 58 of the Cashflow Connections podcast. Our topic for today is scaling from triplexes to purchasing a 225-unit apartment complex. Today, we're going to be talking with a syndicator who has been involved in a variety of different transactions, a variety of different sizes, previously focused on triplexes, fourplexes, not as scalable, and partly because of that, he is now focused on 100-unit plus apartment buildings. He is very cautious about the current state of the market, particularly in multifamily, but is still finding deals that he believes can protect and grow investors' capital. In this episode, we're going to discuss why our guest won't even consider investing in a fourplex and is exclusively focusing on properties that have about a $10 million purchase price or more. We're also going to take a high-level review of the underwriting assumptions of the property that he's really in the process of looking at right now. And we're going to summarize the projections in terms of the trailing 12-month financials. We're going to look at the NOI versus the projected NOI in year five. We're going to talk about the implications of this. What type of equity are they growing? What is the cap rate changing from and to? Yes, this is a little bit dry, but hey, it's the Cashflow Connections podcast. We like to get into the numbers for these types of things. And I think it's really important to look at what you're actually getting out of this $1.5 million capital expenditure you're potentially putting into a property. And we're going to talk about what you should do if you're just getting started and want to raise your first $1 million. Now, as of the release of this particular podcast, you only have 14 days left to purchase the super early bird discount tickets for the Intelligent Investors Real Estate Conference, which is taking place November 10th and 11th at the Marina Del Rey Marriott Hotel, beautiful Los Angeles, California. This is, again, presented by Cashflow Connections and our long-term partners over at FIBI. If you haven't yet, do yourself a favor. Go to intelligentinvestors2018.com. You're going to see that we recently updated the site. There's now several of our key speakers are there, and they look awesome all up next to each other. I mean, this is a ton of brain power sitting there right now. The fact that all these people are going to be in the same room at the same time is just remarkable. I mean, you look at one of our guests is Chris Tortolot from Laterra Development. He's the managing director over there. They were recently ranked as the number one most active developer in Southern California. I think they have 15 deals that are in some stage of development right now. And these are massive prime properties. I'm talking about $1 billion of development in the pipeline right now. He's going to be at this conference. The purchase price with the $100 CFC discount code is $395. Now, do you think that he may have something to offer, some key takeaways, one or two, that may be worth that $395 purchase price? My bet is that he definitely will. Now, keep in mind, of course, he is just one of many speakers, probably going to have somewhere in the range of 20 or 30 because we're doing a lot of panels. I think it's the best way to get the most amount of content as quickly as possible. So overall, I think it's going to be a great investment of your $395. So go to intelligentinvestors2018.com. Make sure to use the discount code CFC when you check out. And remember that the super early bird is only available until September 19th. So go there, get the tickets, one or two or five or 10. And I will see you in Marina Del Rey, November 10th and 11th. And I hope you enjoy the episode. Actually, one thing real quick. I recorded this interview with the microphone pointed the wrong direction. So there is a little bit of a technical difficulty there. I'm sorry, it won't happen again. I appreciate your patience. All right, enjoy the episode. How's it going, everyone? Our guest for today is Jeff Greenberg, who is an MBA with more than 40 years of experience in management, staff supervision, development, and training. Since 2007, Jeff has been investing in multifamily and student housing assets in emerging markets. He also focuses on aspects of projects including investor relationships, business systems and development, acquisitions and asset management. Also, Jeff is the current CEO of Synergetic Investment Group, LLC, which has been involved in multifamily or student housing properties with more than $30 million, consisting of over 800 units. And I've actually known Jeff for quite some time. It's the first time on the podcast. Jeff, thanks again for coming on.
Well, thank you very much, Hunter.
So I actually am really interested to hear what you've been working on, because I know that we met probably about 8 years ago, and I've seen your name pop up. I think that's probably mutual, but let's start from the very, very beginning. You know, what's the first deal that you did? How did you get involved in the real estate sector as a whole?
Well, the first deal that I actually did was a small syndication. It was actually a 20-unit property in Harlingen, Texas. But that was, so I went straight into commercial real estate and I skipped by the single family route, except for my own personal residence. So I jumped right into that one and we syndicated that deal. And that was in 2010.
Okay, great. And did you say where that property was?
It was in Harlingen, Texas. That's near Brownsville, right near where SpaceX is going to be doing some launches coming up soon.
Do you still have that property?
No, we sold that in 2016.
Got it. So you skipped the single family world, went straight into the syndications. Did you actually, were you responsible for raising money for that deal, or what was your role in that first opportunity?
That was, yes, but I had a business partner and both of us raised the money for it. It was $350,000 we had to raise, and we were scared to death, and it took us a long time to do it. But we did accomplish that.
And how has the business model changed since that first investment that you made? How active are you guys right now? Are you looking at similar assets? Give me an understanding of how that's changed through the years.
Well, my company has changed that I no longer am with that particular business partner. We broke off very amicably about 3 years ago. And for a while, I was doing it on my own. And then I met up with a group of people that were interested in learning multifamily. I started training them, and we eventually moved that into where we formed a company, where we purchased two properties last year and are coming up on two properties for this year as well. But as far as the changes, we've gone to larger properties. We're looking in all different markets around the country, and the structure of the companies changed significantly.
Give me some insight into, number one, what markets you're actually looking in, like actively, and then also you mentioned the change in the structure. I'm interested to hear that as well.
Okay. As far as the markets, we are looking in the Southeast. We're looking in the Carolinas. We do like Atlanta, except it's pretty frothy right now. So we are looking in some of the outskirt areas. I also like being in the Arizona market. It's nice to have properties close to California where we can go and look at them without too long of a flight. Those are the major areas. I do have a property up in Ohio. We do have a property in Tucson and one in Georgia. But I do like the Southeast and still some over on the West. Just can't quite do anything in California, though. So that's kind of the markets. We do look at other markets. If we do see properties coming in, we will put the time and effort in to learn about a market. When we see a property that we like, we'll decide whether or not we do want to be in that market. So we are open to different markets. And as far as the structure of my team, I have about 9 people right now. 4 of them are pretty much doing acquisitions where they're talking to brokers, they're bringing in deals. We have another 3 people that are doing underwriting, that are evaluating the deals. I have a team lead that runs pretty much the team, and he also has a debt financing background, so he pretty much handles all of the debt needs when we go into these deals, as well as overseeing pretty much most of the activities of the team. Right now, most of my role is with equity raising. I talk to a lot of people, meet a lot of people, and do most of that, as well as of course, overseeing the entire team, as well as training and activities.
When you're talking about outsourcing some significant pieces of the due diligence process, how did you go through that process of putting a system in place so that someone else could implement the type of due diligence that you typically do or historically did do on these types of properties?
Well, I'm not outsourcing them. These people are trained by me and part of our team, and I'm working closely with them. In fact, one of our team members and myself just came back from Texas last week on a due diligence tour. So that part of it, we're not outsourcing. One of the things that we will be doing outsourcing on this particular deal is the lease audit and the individual unit walkthrough. The property is 225 units, and we've established what we want them to be looking for. This third party is a property management company, so this is their area of expertise, and they're going to be walking through the property with my list of requirements on what we want to know about every single unit, and as well as what we want to know on lease audits. But this is something they do on an ongoing basis. So this is probably the first time that I haven't gone and walked through every single unit, but we will be hiring the management company to go through that and do that for us.
Understood. Yeah, I do appreciate the clarification versus outsources versus onboarding. I suppose if you're hiring someone to fulfill a role within your own firm, that's more of an onboarding case. When you're outsourcing, that's really hiring an outside source to really go through that, like the example you gave, walking those units. So I appreciate the clarification there. Is this deal more along the lines of what you anticipate focusing on going forward? I know that your background, you have done some fourplexes, some fiveplexes, but these 225 units, are these where you see the opportunity right now going forward, is just a unique opportunity?
Definitely, we want to look for the larger units, at least the 100 pluses. This is a nice size unit. We would like to continue getting these size units. As far as with the student housing that we're also involved with, we may go with some smaller units. We like at least 200 beds. So we are looking at one right now that we should be having the contract assigned this week, which will be, I believe, 280 beds on that one. So the number of units is smaller. I believe that one's a 72 unit, but this one is rented by the bed. So to answer the question, yes, this is the size we're looking at. We will go somewhat smaller, but we're also looking larger as well.
What are the cap rates that you're seeing in these types of opportunities?
Well, it all depends. And cap rate, I'm finding, is not nearly as important as I thought it was years ago. Years ago, we used to, you know, tell the broker, here's what we want as in a cap rate. Now it's more of what value adds are available. So my going in cap rate isn't as critical. And a lot of times we're seeing, six and a half cap rates going in, but we also need a significant value add. We're trying to add value to these properties. I don't want just a stabilized property that's turnkey already, you know, jump right in and run it. We need something that it has issues of some kind that we need to solve to bring that value up. So cap rate isn't as critical as it used to be. It's more on what we could bring the value up and what kind of IRR we can get for our investors.
What issues does this current, let's say, 225 unit property have that you're seeing an opportunity to satisfy or solve?
Right now, there's about 10 units that are down. They're hard down. They were damaged they had some water damage. So we're going to be bringing those up. So the occupancy is going to come up. There also has not been any upgrades in this property in years. So we want to upgrade it. The appearance of the property has definitely some needs. It's in a great area. It's near medical centers. It's a highly visible location right off the highway. There's a lot of things that we want to do to kind of bring up the level of the clientele. There is a pool house that is in total disarray that we'd like to make into a rec center and make the area more conducive to a higher level of clientele. So we would like to bring the level of clientele in a little higher. And by doing that, being able to raise the rents. And there's other things. There's some other management issues that need to be handled. But for the most part, we're looking at bringing a better class into the property.
Okay. And what class do you think the property is starting at? And where will you be? Is this a class B to a class A, class C to a class B? What range is that?
The class is a C. It's working class. And it's not bad. I would say it's a middle C clientele. I just feel that with the proximity to this huge regional medical center, that we can bring it up to at least a C plus, or if not a B. We're not talking about major changes in the pricing structure, but just some small improvements that will significantly hit the bottom line. When you're dealing with a property of this size, it doesn't take a lot of increase in rents or increase in RUBS allowances, reimbursements, to make a significant change on the bottom line.
Makes sense. And that's one of the benefits of real estate as a whole, particularly commercial real estate, 100 unit plus you mentioned, is just the scalability when it comes to adding significant value. So just like, let's run through a quick calculation here. What type of rent growth are you anticipating for implementing these value add strategies, especially when it comes to amenities and in the door upgrades?
Just off the top of my head, I mean, if we increase the rent or the income, so which could be part rent, could also be increase in the percentage of RUBS that we're bringing in. Right now, I believe they're bringing in about 75% of the rent, the utility expenses through a third party RUBS company, and I feel that can be increased. Even if we brought that up, you know, $10 per month per unit on the RUBS, you multiply that out to, you know, the 225 units and put that in on even on a 7 cap, that's a fairly significant amount of money. On top of that, if we get the rents up, say another $40 or $50, that significantly adds to the value of the property, way above what we feel that we're going to be putting into it.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Quick, thanks for the clarification. Let's say $10,000, maybe $13,000 per month to the NOI, you know, times 12 divided by a 7 cap. You're getting up there pretty quickly in terms of equity added if you're able to implement those changes. What do the loans look like on a property like this? Or what the typical financing that you're seeing that's available right now?
Well, on this particular one, we're going to go with some agency financing because it is, we're right at the 90% occupancy right now. So we're able to get into an agency loan. And so the terms are pretty decent for that. In the past, we've got into either bridge loans or just private lenders in order to get in, depending on what was the stress point on the particular deal.
You mentioned the agency debt and the occupancy. What other metrics do those agencies require that you have in place in order to get that type of financing?
Well, I mean, they're happy with the market. They're happy with, you know, the size of the property, the loan size. As far as the sponsors, they're comfortable with us. They're comfortable with the debt coverage ratio. Those are the main things. The stability of the property, you know, they look at all that.
Yeah, if you don't mind, give us a couple of those metrics because I know that the listeners will be interested. I mean, you mentioned the loan size. This is one of the great reasons that scaling up to those 225 units is so advantageous. It's easier to get a $10 million loan than it is to get a $300,000 loan. So give us some of those metrics in terms of the DSCR, the loan size, the LTV, et cetera.
Well, the DSCR, they were looking at a 130, but there has been a little bit of volatility in the rents on this particular property. But they did let us go down to a 1.25 on the debt service.
Okay.
As far as most of the other details, like I said, I've got my team lead handles most of my debt side of it. So I don't know all of the ins and outs as far as what we're doing on that end of it. But he has more of that information.
Okay. And, you know, you mentioned that you look at a lot of agency debt. Do you typically find regional banks or other, like when you say bridge loans, do those typically come from private lenders or from regional banks in the area that you're familiar with, or where are the sources coming from on those?
Well, the ones I've done prior, they've come from usually capital sources of different flavors. My Ohio deal, we actually end up closing that one with a private bank. The problem with typically working with your banks, you've got a shorter amortization, the number of years that you're going to divide the numbers out. Typically, their interest rate is higher. their terms are not as good as the agency. Using the bridge loan, we actually went on a bridge loan with our Arizona property, not because there was any problem or issue with the property. We had a problem with the timeline that the seller had to close. You know, we had a hard close by December 28th of last year. And the lender we were talking to that was going to get us an agency debt said that they couldn't promise us that we would close within that timeline. And so we ended up with more expensive debt just because we had this hard closed timeline. And so the interest rate was a little bit higher than we would have gotten from Fannie or Freddie.
Could you give us a sense of that delta there, the difference between the two? Because I think that's a really interesting part of this story, which is that you can get things done quickly. Sometimes you can't get them done both quickly and inexpensively, and you certainly can't do it with the right lender if the case is the other two are. Give us an idea of what the interest rate would have been and what the length of that bridge loan was.
Well, the bridge loan is actually 3 years. We could extend it another two if we want. Right now, it's interest only. The interest, I think we're at 7% on that one.
Okay.
But right now, we're doing interest only, and we can roll into their perm loan. They do have a perm loan that is more competitive with the agencies, but it's still not as good as we could get right now as far as agency. Back then, we probably could have gotten an agency loan at maybe about 4.5 interest. Now, I think we're looking more at 4.9 or something. I think that's what we're looking at. So those are the main things. Now, also, you've got the prepayment penalty issue. Now, on a bridge, you don't really have the prepayment, but there is going to be, you know, some percentages that you pay in there. There's a few expenses here and there. So if we want to go from the bridge to a Fannie product, we could, but there's some costs in there as well. So the bridge, you know, the bridge fills that need sometimes, but certainly if you can get into agency, you're going to get better terms.
You mentioned earlier that you were planning on doing some light capital expenditure. Could you give me an idea of what that capital expenditure breaks down on a per door basis?
You're talking about on this, the current deal?
Yeah, that 225 unit.
That one, we're budgeting $6,000 a door, but we don't expect that we're going to be hitting all of the units. So we may end up hitting $8,000 a door on some of the units and maybe $2,000 a door on some of the other. But we did put in the budget about $6,000 a door to do that. The other thing is I mentioned some of the curb appeal and the aesthetics. There are some issues on this property on the parking lot, and I think it's a major issue as far as just the aesthetics of seeing this parking lot with holes and cracks and alligator all over it. So in order to upgrade the appearance of it to get a higher class of tenant, we will be putting some money into that. And actually, I'm expecting my asphalt bids to be coming in today. So this will be interesting to see how much that's going to be costing.
Is that $6,000 a door inclusive of those external amenity upgrades as well?
No. We've got, okay. I believe we've got another $200,000 or so that we're looking in addition. We've got some more in there allocated for some of the other stuff. And the other thing that we're looking at doing, and one of the things that's nice about the agency, is in the next 2 years, if we bring up the value of the property, we can also go and get a supplemental, which is kind of like a second with the agency to pull some additional money if we want to do some additional repairs as well. If we want to do some upgrades. Once we've increased the value of the property, now we will have additional equity and we could use some of it for additional capital work. We may be able to use some of it to give back to the investors to lower the basis as far as the amount of equity we have invested.
So it sounds like, let's say, 1.5 or 1.6 million in capital expenditure on the property overhaul, including the, let's say, the 6,000 per door plus the 200,000 on the amenities and the parking lot, et cetera. Is that kind of in the range that you're anticipating?
Right. Yes.
From a cap rate basis, walk us through what you're anticipating in terms of, let's say, the trailing 12, and then the first year, the second year, and then let's say year six, or somewhere in that range if you've run those calculations, just in terms of what that capital expenditure will result in.
Well, according to their numbers, they're showing us that we're buying it at a 7.2 cap. According to our numbers, we're looking at a more at a 6.3 cap, according to what we feel are appropriate numbers.
Okay. And then once you do implement that, let's say $1.6 million in capital expenditure, what do you anticipate the cap rate being based on your original purchase price, let's say in year six? So just take the year six NOI divided by the purchase price that you're about to purchase the property for.
I have it calculated out to year five, but I can get you.
Okay, year five's fine.
I've got an NOI at year five on $1,120,036.
Okay.
If you want the change.
Cool. And then we'll say you bought the property for 10.5 plus 1.5 in capital expenditure. So you're in for about 12, I'd say. Does that make sense? Is that kind of in line with your anticipation?
Yeah.
So the $10.5 million purchase price plus the 1.5 in capital expenditure.
Yeah.
So let's say buying the property at a 6.3 cap and turning into a 9.3 cap is kind of in the range that you're anticipating.
Yes.
Based on your original purchase price. Okay, awesome. Yeah, that's definitely slid like a 30% increase in the cap rate. And that's not a number that a lot of people use, but I just like to look at it from a cash flow basis. One of the things that I've found challenging about the duplex, triplex, first of all, are you still pursuing the duplex, triplex business model, or is it almost exclusively on these multi-units now?
No, we don't look at small properties at all. I don't even look at properties under 70 units, probably not even under 100 units right now, unless it's student housing. Student housing, as I said, if there's enough beds, we may look on the smaller, but certainly not down that small.
The student housing industry is really interesting. What do you find so compelling about that asset class? I know the demand, is obviously quite solid. You can really identify really quality markets that are positioned next to universities. What are some of the things you find compelling about that asset class?
Well, the one thing is that we do find a lot of them that are in distress because of mismanagement. Two of the three that we have were mismanaged. And because of that, there was great value in correcting the management and getting them up marketed properly. It's a unique niche as far as property management's concerned. And if handled improperly, you could have real problems that you don't get it leased up at the proper time, at the proper rate. You may be sitting on the property for a year and having, a half empty property. And so we do find that we're finding a lot of properties that are in distress. And in fact, our Georgia property was it was already foreclosed on. We bought it from the note holder. And that's one of the things. The other thing is I like the stability in down markets. The student housing typically does fairly well during recessions. And they did fairly well during our deep recession that we had. So I like that for the stability. I like that you're getting a higher value, a higher revenue source from a smaller property and able to squeeze that. But if you do it right, student housing could be very lucrative and, just a good asset class.
When it comes to managing those assets, especially since you're looking out of state, what are some of the ways that you conduct due diligence on the actual property management team, the on-site management team?
Well, typically we're doing our due diligence on the management company, and because we may change over as far as the on-site people, but it's the management company. I want a management company that has a lot of experience in student housing, or they even specialize and only do student housing, because it is a whole different ballgame as far as marketing the properties, as far as turnovers, as far as working with the students. It's really a lot different and can be extremely time consuming if they're not set up for it, especially the marketing end of it, the social media, the going to the on-campus events. A lot of that stuff, isn't typically done with a regular property management company. A lot of property management companies, they'll put your ad on apartment.com and, you know, put it on Craigslist or something, and then they're done. There's a lot more to it on the student housing, you know, social media, digital media. There's, going to campus events, going, to all different things, having a table set up with a booth and, whatever. So it's just a whole different marketing strategy.
Certainly. It's a niche that definitely requires thorough knowledge about the actual tenant base, which is very focused. When you do invest in senior housing, are you investing in markets that are specifically focused on one particular university? As in, are you positioned right next to a campus, for example, or is it just student housing generally in a market where there's multiple universities and you anticipate there being demand for the product because of that?
On the student housing aspects, when you're looking for a market, it is a lot different than when you're doing multifamily. And yes, we are looking for a specific university and the distance from a specific university. Typically, the maximum we want to be is 2 miles from the university, preferably a lot closer. My Georgia property is right across the street. You can throw stones to the university. The one in Ohio is within what they call the mile square. And everybody in the mile square is pretty much 100% occupied. Those beyond the mile square start to peter out as far as the occupancy. Or if you happen to be real close to the bar district, then you may also be able to get the higher rents and the higher occupancy. So it's either near the school or near the bar district as far as that's concerned. But you don't want to be, much farther than 2 miles out. You know, our Arizona property is just right on the border of 2 miles out, and it's never going to be one of the higher end offerings. We're always going to be a lower end offering, but that's something we knew coming into it, and we're priced in that range. But those properties that are much closer are going to get a much higher dollar value. So you want to be within a mile, 2 miles at the most, of a major university.
Okay, yeah, and I appreciate you kind of going through that there, because I know it's an asset class we actually haven't really talked about specifically on the podcast before, but it's definitely an interesting way, and I do agree that it is very recession resistant, so definitely something to keep an eye on. You mentioned that your main focus in the firm is meeting investors, growing the business, building relationships with other investors, et cetera, and dealing with a lot of investor communication. What are some of the ways that you've been able to facilitate that? What are some of the ways in which you've sourced investors? How have you built those relationships that have really been meaningful and created long-lasting investors?
Well, I mean, I go to a lot of different events where I talk to a lot of people. I've been running two different clubs out in California for one of them has been at least 4 years now. The other one has been since 2005, I believe. So I've been involved with that one for about 13 years. Meeting people, podcasts like this put me in front of a lot of people where I get to meet a lot of people as well. But I go to different activities, not just real estate, chamber of commerce activities, different charity organizations that I may get involved with. Just meeting lots of people and just sharing my vision of what's going on in the real estate business and what we're doing as a company. And typically the question comes up and says, oh, how can I get involved? Or, is there a way I can invest with you? And then we're off to the, we're off and doing business.
What would you say is a limiting factor in the firm right now? Is it access to deal flow? Is it market conditions? Is it access to different investors or additional investor capital? What would you say would be the one thing that if you could focus on that, resolve that right now, that you'd be able to scale, continue to scale more effectively?
I would say good deal flow. And I say good deal flow because we do get a lot of deal flow. We get a lot of deals. My team over the last 2.5 years, we have a database. I believe last time I looked, it was about 750 deals. that we've gone through and thrown into the database, where out of those deals, we've probably put offers in maybe 30 or 40 of them. And we're so far, we've in the last 2 years, we've closed on two last year. We've got two that we should be closing on this year. So there's a lot of properties for sale out there. Finding the good value add deals is always the difficult problem. And I'm very concerned about where we are in the market right now. And that's why I won't accept just stabilized properties. I want properties that have some significant value add. They're cash flowing currently for the most part, and that we can add significant value, that the market is doing significantly well. And we're very patient, that we have nothing forcing us to get deals. If I do one deal a year or 2 deals a year or 5 deals a year, you know, that's the way it's going to be. But we have our standards, and we stick by those, and there's no pressure to do more deals.
Right. That does make sense. Basically, it's really important to keep your underwriting standards in check right now, particularly late in the cycle. If you're able to execute and deliver on your promises to your investors, when things do turn around and there is a open windfall of opportunity, you can take advantage of it. As long as you're continuing to stay active, look at new deals and delivering your promises to your current investors, you're actually able to do that. So I do appreciate that insight, and also, you know, respect that strategy as well. Let's say if there was someone that was just now getting into commercial real estate space and they want to focus on raising money in the same way that you do, what advice would you give them? What direction would you suggest that they go? And what could you tell them that really supercharged your career, and particularly as it relates to raising capital?
Well, the first thing is you need to associate yourself with someone with experience. You can't just go and raise money and expect people to trust you if you really haven't done anything. And this is something I'm constantly speaking to my team about, is that just being associated, being a part of the deal, being able to go in and see the inner workings of a deal, and then being able to, you know, go in and close on deals. And then I tell them constantly, share with everybody you meet what you've been doing, what, you know, what you've been working on, what you learned, you know, this last go round. And that's the best way you can gain credibility, by association with somebody that's doing whatever it is that you want to do. You know, you don't have to go into these expensive mentoring programs, even though, you know, some people do and some people gain from that. I'm always open to gaining knowledge, but I think the best knowledge is gained when you're actually doing something with somebody. I do believe in an apprenticeship program, an internship program, where you're learning from somebody actually doing it. When I first took part of my team out on our first due diligence trip, where we walked in and out of each unit and we did lease audits and we did all that stuff together, you know, what better learning platform is there than actually being on site doing things? And if you could find somebody that, you know, will allow you to help them out and do things with them and be a part of the team, that is the best way not only to get credibility, but to learn as well. And that credibility is what's going to help you raise the money.
Agree completely. And I appreciate you sharing that. And I also think that's a great note to end it on, because if anyone is out there that is looking to get into space, you can really supercharge your career by associating with the right people. It is very challenging to make a career in real estate on an island. It is almost impossible. It is not like investing in something like high-frequency trading algorithms, for example, in the sense that it's very difficult to make a lot of money sitting in front of a computer. You have to be out there making relationships, shaking hands, and building your network. And it just relies on so many other people. So if that's the one thing you focus on, I guarantee you will be successful regardless of your level of expertise. And that expertise will come along once that network is built up. So, Jeff, before we run, let the listeners know how they can learn more about your firm and what you do.
Well, they can go to my website, which is synergeticig.com. That's S-Y-N-E-R-G-E-T-I-C jeffmcgee.com. You go to my website or my email. You can get me at jeff@synergeticig.com. Same spelling.
Awesome. Well, Jeff, that information will be in the show notes page. I really appreciate you coming on. Thanks again.
Thank you very much, Hunter. I enjoyed it.
All right, listeners, thanks for checking out the episode. As always, the contact information for our guest will be available in the show notes page, which is hosted on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Stitcher. Don't forget, if you want access to some of the free goodies that I'm talking about at the beginning of these episodes, like free ebooks, weekly investor emails, and articles about some of the most important investment-related topics, make sure that you have created an account with CFC, because this stuff is automatically available. You can do this by going to cashflowconnections.com and signing up as an accredited investor. Of course, if you have any questions, feel free to email me at hunterthompson@cashflowconnections.com. Thanks again.